and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
Hey, I want y'all to take a mental note of the up-and-coming show Calculated Conversations, hosted by my brother David Jefferson and myself, Ken Jones, where we get deep into the shared consciousness of popular culture and discuss our understanding of that very thing. Every Tuesday from 7 to 8 p.m. on KBOO, the community's radio station. Get ready for the stimulation.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Washington Governor Jay Inslee vetoed a bill that essentially gave state lawmakers near-total exemption from state public records law.
The Oregon legislature is considering a bill that they say would increase funds available for affordable housing projects.
And we'll hear about the Beagle Freedom Bill, which aims to stop the laboratory testing of products on dogs chosen for their trusting nature.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 2nd, 2018. I'm Ruben Lawrence.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. On any list of problems facing the state of Oregon, the lack of affordable housing is at or near the top. The Oregon legislature, which wraps up this year's short session on March 11th, is considering a bill that would increase the funds available for affordable housing projects. KBOO reporter Miranda Krause has this story from the Oregon News Service.
Oregon legislators are considering a way to increase funds for affordable housing efforts around the state. House Bill 4007 would increase the document recording fee when a person buys a home from $20 to $60 to generate about $90 million over 2 years. The new funds would add money to programs that help prevent homelessness, build affordable housing, and provide home ownership assistance. It would also create a program to help first-time buyers save for a home. Allison McIntosh with Neighborhood Partnerships, a group that coordinates the Oregon Housing Alliance, says there is dire need for affordable housing all over the state.
In the coast and in Hood River, we hear stories about teachers sleeping in their vans or driving over the passes to get to work and commuting long distances just to find an affordable home. In Southern Oregon, in the Medford area, the vacancy rate is less than 1%, so home prices are getting more and more expensive.
One out of every $4 in the legislation would be dedicated to helping veterans with housing needs. Opponents of this bill say increasing the recording fee means too few people would carry the financial burden. The bill is now in the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Oregon Food Bank is supporting the bill because of the close connection between hunger and the ability to find an affordable home. Annalise Kohler with Oregon Food Bank says more and more people are coming to food pantries and meal sites with concerns about the rising cost of housing.
They talk about housing issues, so they talk about rent being too high, about being scared, about being evicted, about being unable to find a place to live. And so it's really become one of the driving forces behind why people need emergency food.
A 2017 count by the state found homelessness in Oregon had increased 6% since 2015.
That was KBOO reporter Miranda Krause with a story from the Oregon News Service written by Eric Teganoff.
For years, Washington state legislators have been denying public records requests for calendars, emails, and other documents related to their official business. The problem was so bad that a coalition of news organizations, including the Associated Press and the Seattle Times, sued the state legislature to force them to comply with the state's Public Records Act. In January, a judge ruled in favor of the media outlets, and Washington's elected lawmakers set about putting their houses in order, not by complying with the judge's order, but by using their legislative power to change the law. Within 48 hours of being introduced, Senate Bill 667 6617 had passed the House and Senate with no debate and a veto-proof majority. The bill exempted legislators from the Public Records Act, gave them authority to decide what records would be released and hear appeals on challenges. Oh, and SB 6617 was retroactive, meaning it would nullify any requests still pending or in appeals.
Public outcry was immediate and deafening. Newspapers throughout the state printed front-page editorials condemning the bill. The governor's office received over 6,000 calls and 1,200 emails. By the time the bill got to Governor Jay Inslee's desk yesterday, he was determined to veto it. Though the initial vote was veto-proof, calls and emails to the offices of state legislators had prompted a change of heart in the halls of power. Both Democrats and Republicans released statements assuring their constituents that they would not seek to overturn Inslee's veto. Instead, the legislature will form a committee made up of legislators, transparency advocates, media representatives, and other stakeholders to put together recommendations for the 2019 legislative session.
Residents of San Juan, Puerto Rico, lost power for the second day in a row today as the island's power system struggled to recover from Hurricane Maria. On Thursday, 800,000 customers in and around the capital lost power after a transmission line failed at one of the two main power stations. The backup station that would normally mitigate the outage has gone unrepaired since September. San Juan Mayor Carmen Yulin Cruz tweeted that the line that caused yesterday's blackout had previously been, quote, fixed by Whitefish Energy. The tiny two-person Montana company secured a $300 million contract with Puerto Rico's utility company PREPA to restore power to the island after Maria. When details of the suspicious contract were reported by the Washington Post, Congress and the FBI launched investigations into the deal. After less than a month of Whitefish's price gouging and ineptitude, the contract was canceled. Now the governor of Puerto Rico is talking about privatizing PREPA, which is deeply in debt. Close to 500,000 people are still without power 4 months after Hurricane Maria. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers hopes to have power fully restored by May.
A new report investigates the booming bottled water industry. The report finds that companies rely on predatory tactics for sales of water that cost almost 2,000 times as much as tap water. KBOO's Jasmine Moneymaker, in conjunction with the Oregon News Service, has more.
Sales are skyrocketing for the bottled water industry, but what are companies actually selling to customers? In its new report, Take Back the Tap, Food and Water Watch researchers look at the booming business of bottled water, which surpassed soda in sales in 2016. The group finds nearly 64% of bottled water comes from municipal taps, and that it cost almost 2,000 times as much as tap water and 4 times as much as gasoline. Patty Lavera with Food and Water Watch says bottled water companies target demographics through advertising, especially immigrant communities.
It is much more the norm in other countries where you have to go buy bottled water because the safety systems aren't there for tap water. That's not the case in most American cities. That's pretty predatory to convince people they need to keep spending their hard-earned money to do that and undermining people's confidence in tap water.
Bottled water companies say their water actually is safer. The report also found about 70% of bottles aren't recycled and that 4 billion pounds of plastic were used to produce bottles in 2016. That's enough to fill the Empire State Building 1.3 times. Activists also have raised concerns that companies that do rely on groundwater are depleting people's local water supplies and hurting the ecosystem. For a decade, Nestle has tried to open bottling plants in the Columbia River Gorge, but failed. In 2016, people in Cascade Locks voted to ban large bottling facilities. Lavera says the company kept trying to open a facility in the town until Governor Kate Brown killed its chances for good last year.
The governor weighed in and basically blocked a fairly complicated deal that would have let Nestle do a water transfer to get access to build a water facility in the Columbia River Gorge. So it's a huge issue for communities when they see the volumes of water that would be removed.
Lavera says even though most tap water systems are safe, the country's water infrastructure is in need of maintenance, especially in places such as Flint, Michigan, and that federal funding is the best avenue for that. But she adds that it can be difficult to get support for this idea.
it's hard to build that political will if people think that you buy water at the grocery store and you just have to go take care of it that way. We kind of undermine this sense of ownership and accountability for having a tap water system that works for everybody.
In conjunction with Oregon News Service, Jasmine Moneymaker, KBOO News.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, a weekly news show from the Center for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. At 6, it's Bread and Roses. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 33 degrees, with a 20% chance of rain. Tomorrow, expect some sun and a high of 50 degrees. March is Women's History Month. Today, March 2nd, saw the opening of the Martha Washington Hotel in New York City in 1903, the first hotel exclusively for women. The similarly named Martha Washington Hotel for Self-Supporting Women opened in Portland in 1917 after planning by the Portland Women's Union. It currently serves as low-income housing owned by Home Forward. Today also marks the birthday in 1901 of Greta Hermann, a German mathematician who did early philosophical work on quantum mechanics that remained obscure until the 1970s. Experts have said that her work would have altered the course of the development of quantum mechanics if it had been more widely known. The quote of the day is from free jazz pianist Cecil Taylor, who said, quote, "Someone once asked me if I was gay. I said, do you think a three-letter word defines the complexity of my humanity? I avoid the trap of easy definition," end quote.
KBOO's Ray Bodwell found himself in an uncomfortable position earlier this week. He realized he was in agreement with Donald Trump on something.
I woke up on Wednesday morning in an alternate universe. I found myself in support of a position taken by Donald Trump. It actually started on Monday when he said this during comments about the school shooting in Parkland, Florida.
When we see somebody is sick like this guy, when the police went to see him, they didn't do a good job, but they have restrictions on what they can do. We got to give them immediate access to taking those guns away.
Then on Wednesday, in a meeting with Republican and Democratic senators, he continued to hit the right note. When John Cronin, Republican of Texas, raised the issue of bump stocks, the devices that allow the rapid fire of semi-automatic weapons, Trump said this.
We can do that with an executive order. I'm going to write the bump stock, essentially write it out.
Democrat Chris Murphy of Connecticut brought up the issue of background checks.
97% of Americans want universal background checks. In states that have universal background checks, there are 35% less gun murders than in states that don't have them, and yet we can't get it done.
Throughout Murphy's talk, Trump nodded in the affirmative and then said this.
We have to pursue common sense measures that protect the rights of law-abiding Americans while keeping guns. We have to keep the guns out of the hands of those that pose the threat. And this really includes background checks. I'm looking at a number of the folks around the table. You're working on different bills. We have to get them done.
He addressed the ridiculous difference in age requirements when purchasing a handgun versus an assault rifle.
You can't buy a handgun at 18, 19, or 20. You have to wait till you're 21. But you can buy the gun, the weapon used in this horrible shooting at 18.
And finally, he addressed the elephant in the room, the National Rifle Association.
I'm a big fan of the NRA, but I had lunch with them on Sunday and said, it's time. We got to stop this nonsense. It's time.
Although the whole thing feels like an out-of-body experience, I haven't completely lost my mind. I do realize that this is still the Donald. He just named a campaign chairman for his 2020 re-election bid, and this could be an effort to appear presidential and broaden his base. Earlier today, word came out that he's already backing away from his pro-gun control stance. And even if Trump does stand firm, which now appears unlikely, we know that the NRA is not going to slink away with their tail between their legs. Their staunchest defenders, like Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, immediately began shooting holes in Trump's arguments. They are mobilizing their base and are no doubt spreading cash around and calling in their markers throughout Congress. At Wednesday's meeting, Trump chided some members about being afraid of the NRA, but it looks like that may have been just a typical Trump cheap shot. So why did he bring up the idea of gun control in the first place? Obviously, I'm only guessing, but I think the kids got to him. He's got children and grandchildren, and maybe it briefly dawned on him that in the armed camp that is the United States, no one is safe. And with his long support of the NRA, he just might be, and this is still a huge if, the guy who can get it done. And no, these restrictions don't go as far as they need to, but at least it's a start. Because the kids are right. Enough is enough, and we've got to start somewhere. So even though I personally despise Trump more than any other president in my 65 years, I'm rooting for him to follow through on this one. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
Each year, millions of animals are subjected to laboratory testing for research. For many of these tests, man's best friend is used, and that best friend is usually a beagle. 96% of dogs chosen for testing are beagles due to their small size and forgiving demeanor. After a lab has no use for these animals, most are euthanized. In an attempt to ensure that these beagles have a chance at life after labs, the animal rights organization, the Rescue and Freedom Project, created the Beagle Freedom Bill. This bill ensures that animals tested at taxpayer-funded research facilities have the opportunity to have a life post-testing. The bill successfully passed in 2014 in the state of Minnesota, with California, Nevada, Connecticut, and New York passing similar bills in the years since. Now, in 2018, similar bills are being considered in six more states. On a recent episode of KBOO's Voices for the Animals, host Courtney Scott got a chance to speak with Matt Rossell, campaign and policy director at the Rescue and Freedom Project, to learn more about their bill.
Well, it's unfortunate for them that their docile, friendly, forgiving nature is the exact reason why they're both, you know, the fifth most popular dog for people to have in their homes and the number one most popular dog for research animals. They, you know, no matter what you do to them, they are forgiving and don't resist and don't bite, and it's why they're used. And also just their size, they're a smaller breed of dog that fits well in a cage. A lot, as you know, a lot of animal research is really about the money, and it's about efficiency, and they're run like an assembly line, is what I experience inside of the research labs. These labs are really about making money and about continuing a type of research that there are so many vested interests, from the pharmaceutical companies to the researchers themselves and all the companies that supply the products and cages and everything and the animals for testing, all have an interest in keeping this going. And the beagles happen to fit in that formula well because they're a small-sized dog. It's easier to keep them than some other.
Yeah. And what happens to the ones that don't get, you know, whatever? They don't make it to someplace. They euthanize quite a number of them, I imagine.
Well, the unfortunate thing about animals used in research is that at the end of the experiment, the animal almost always is killed. And this is true whether or not the animals are healthy or adoptable, or whether they need to use them, or they purport to need to use them and euthanize them for the experiment. And that is, because of that, one of our projects that we've been working on is legislation called the Beagle Freedom Bill. And this is a compassionate, very common sense, bipartisan, simple bill that is just pointing out this need in the law, that this void in the law, that, you know, there's various rules and federal regulations that these labs do have to follow to a certain extent, certainly not strong enough laws, but there are laws in place that are put in place to protect these animals right up until the end of the experiment. But there is nothing that in the law that says anything about what happens to them once the experiment is over.
Hmm.
And so this bill is filling that void and is simply saying, if the animal is adoptable, if it's healthy, then you need to find a suitable rescue or shelter to offer that animal for adoption. And we're talking specifically in this bill about dogs and cats. And it has now passed in 6 states, and we have close to a dozen other states that have either introduced it or are actively working on passing the bill and discussing the bill right now. And, you know, this is a very middle ground, sort of common ground type of law that doesn't really do anything to affect the research in any way, but it's at a place where everyone should agree, you know,
right.
These animals deserve to have a life after labs, if at all possible. And we're really going to continue to push this bill because we want to see every possible animal come out of those labs and
yeah.
find a happy home.
Well, I hope a lot of them can come out of Oregon National Primate Research Center. So I know they also use beagles there, right?
Yes, there are dogs and cats that are used mm-hmm. at OHS. Use
so let's
labs.
Hope this moves on to Oregon. I'm sure you have something in the works.
Right. Well, maybe we can work with you on
that. Yeah. That was Courtney Scott speaking with Matt Rossell of the Beagle Freedom Project on KBOO's public affairs show, Voices for the Animals. More information can be found about Rescue and Freedom Project's Beagle Freedom Bill at bfp.org.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture from Native Voice One. Find more stories and podcasts at nv1.org.
With National Native News, I'm Daisha Eaton in for Antonia Gonzalez. The new owners of Indian Country Today Media Network promise a hands-off editorial approach as they revive the publication that went dark in September of last year. National Congress of American Indians Executive Director Jacqueline Peta says NCAI will publish the online news site, but it will not be involved in editorial decisions. NCAI advocates for Native American issues and organizes lobbying efforts with federal government leaders. Peta says the public needs a strong, independent Native news source.
An educated public actually helps make better decisions and inform their policy decision makers about the needs of Indian country and the solutions. And I think it also makes a big difference for us wherever we are in Indian country, whether we're in a rural village of Alaska or Navajo or, you know, in an urban center, to feel like we have a connection.
The previous publishers, the Oneida Nation, donated Indian Country Today's assets to NCAI. The new publication will operate as a nonprofit. NCAI hired veteran journalist Mark Trahant as editor. Trahant, who is Shoshone Bannock, says he wants to be partners, not competitors, with other Native media.
We're going to be trying to cover the whole country. One of the, I think, ways we'll be doing that is working with a lot of partnerships. One of the things I'm kind of setting up from the very beginning is that all of our content will be free use, so anybody could use it as long as they credit us.
He is currently the Charles R. Johnson Endowed Professor of Journalism at the University of North Dakota. Trahant is the former editor of the editorial page for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. Haskell Indian Nations University in Lawrence, Kansas, recently held its very first two-spirit powwow, which is believed to be the first of its kind on a tribal college campus. Rhonda Lavaldo has more.
The Cuxa Gym on the Haskell campus was packed as grand entry was underway for the first two-spirit powwow held on the campus. One of the many participants in the event, Amanda Trujillo, expressed her emotions.
Well, as a pansexual woman myself and a supporter of the lesbian gay community, as well as being a full-blood Native, I was compelled to come out here, and this is my first ever two-spirits at powwow. I'm just absolutely thrilled. It's awesome.
Haskell student and organizer for the powwow, Bryce Smiley, Riley said he was overwhelmed with the amount of support they received.
It's just a traditional powwow, as I was told. So just to see the show out, it's really, really awesome. And just to be around your own peers, people who identify the same as you, it feels like a safe place to be. It feels like home, to be honest.
President of Haskell, Dr. Vanita Chenault, was also in attendance and happy they could host the history-making event.
Well, I think it reflects our values that we talk about in terms of respect and recognizing the diversity within our communities here at Haskell. We've got, I understand, visitors from Florida, California, Illinois, Missouri, all coming to support this event.
Funds for the powwow were provided through a grant from the American Indian College Fund. This is Rhonda Lavaldo for National Native News.
No Native-themed films or Native actors are up for Academy Awards this Sunday, but veteran actor Wes Studi is tapped to present an award during the televised ceremony. Studi appears as Chief Yellowhawk in the film Hostiles alongside Christian Bale and Adam Beach. Studi is the first Native American presenter in recent memory. In addition to Hostiles, Studi appeared in Dances with Wolves, Last of the Mohicans, Heat, and Avatar, among others. With National Native News, I'm Daisha Eaton.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ray Bodwell, Miranda Krause, Jasmine Moneymaker, and Jenna Yokoyama. Special thanks to KBOO's Voices of the Animals. The producer for tonight's news is Sam Bowman, our engineer is Jenna Yokoyama, and the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Celos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson-Osterland.
And I'm Reuben Lawrence. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on More Talk Radio, Cecil and Celeste take your calls. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time. At 10, on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein talks with Kevin Martin, president of the group Peace Action and the Peace Action Education Fund. At 11, it's Health Watch with David Naiman and Ellen Goldsmith. And at 11:30, it's Madness Radio, voices and visions from outside mental health with Will Hall. KBOO's Kickstarter is live. Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter and help KBOO build a city of media makers. That's kboo.fm/Kickstarter. Thanks for listening and have a great evening. Good night, Linda.
Good night, Reuben. Good night, Jenna.
Good night, everybody.
This is reporter-producer Jasmine Moneymaker, and you are listening to KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs here on your favorite community radio station, KBOO. KBOO is dedicated to growing the next generation of media makers and has been fundamental to community media for the last 50 years. KBOO holds the spirit of Portland and the Northwest in our daily broadcasts of art, culture, music, and grassroots politics. Donate to our Kickstarter today so that KBOO's roots as a creative and visionary hub of energy will continue to grow and support the next generation of media makers.
Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter.
donate to the campaign, and share it with your friends. And thank you for your support of KBOO.
Oh, that's right. Have you checked out KBOO's Kickstarter? Help us meet that $20,000 goal and help us make a city of media makers. That's kboo.fm/Kickstarter, or you can just go into that Kickstarter website and search for KBOO Community Radio. Build a city of media makers today.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, a 2017 Gallup poll found 61% of Americans approve of labor unions, despite the fact that just 11% of wage and salary workers are union members, and despite a decades-long, vehement, multi-layered, and deep-pocketed campaign to incapacitate unions, and really the ability of workers to organize in any way that truly builds power that could contest that of corporate interests. The ability of workers to build collective power